assets. Since an ETN is a debt instrument, investors are then subject to the credit quality of the issuer. If the issuer goes bankrupt, then investors in the ETN may get only a fraction of what they invested in the ETN. Whereas with an ETF, the fund holds the underlying assets. Therefore, investors in an ETN must have faith in the issuer's ability to continue to operate, as well as the issuer's ability to track an index without necessarily owning the basket of assets that make up the index. Issuers of ETNs are usually a bank or financial firm that backs the instrument with its credibility and serves to quell concerns regarding the financial strength of the issuer. Morgan Stanley was the initial issuer of this type of security, and Barclays is also a frequent issuer, both well-diversified international banks with solid ratings. However, as we learned from the crisis of 2008, recognizing and evaluating the underwriting firm is critical and not always so easy to do. As a debt instrument, the health and well-being of the underlying issuer is the added risk that the innovative investor possesses when owning an ETN. As with ETFs, ETNs allow investors to integrate exposure of an asset into their portfolio without having to deal with the messy details of acquiring and securing that asset. For instance, if an investor believes in commodity futures like live cattle, but doesn't want to get involved with trading the actual futures contracts, he or she can invest in an ETN that tracks that futures index. The issuer of that ETN is responsible for delivering the value of that index, minus fees, to the investor upon maturity or early repurchase. Because the ETN trades on an exchange, it's susceptible to market forces and can trade at a premium or discount to its underlying value. Trading on an exchange also allows for liquidity, so an investor can easily buy or sell. ETNs can also be held in standard brokerage or custodial accounts. In October 2015, XBT provider issued Bitcoin Tracker 1, Coin XBT, to track the U.S. dollar price of Bitcoin. Bitcoin Tracker 1 takes the average U.S. dollar exchange rate of Bitcoin from the Bitfinex, Bitstamp, and GDAX exchanges to determine the underlying value of Bitcoin for the investment. The following year, XBT provider issued the Bitcoin Tracker Euro. Both investments were made available through the Interactive Brokers platform, a discount broker service available to investors. For these products, XBT provider charges a 2.5% management fee, 25% higher than the fee Grayscale charges. Perhaps most important for the innovative investor, unlike many ETNs, XBT provider is at all times fully hedged, meaning it holds the underlying Bitcoin equal to the value of the ETN. This can significantly reduce reliance on XBT provider's credit quality, because even if the company goes bankrupt, there should still be the underlying Bitcoin in place to reimburse investors. As stated on the website, XBT provider does not have any market risk. The company always holds Bitcoins equivalent to the value of ETNs issued. In mid-2016, XBT provider was purchased by Global Advisors, Jersey, Limited, Gabby, after XBT provider's main stockholder, KNC Miner, declared bankruptcy. KNC Miner had long been a Bitcoin mining company and producer of Bitcoin mining rigs. With an ETN, the credibility of the underlying issuer is paramount, and Gabby recognized that as well. Following KNC's bankruptcy, trading of XBT provider's two ETNs temporarily paused as a new guarantor was pursued, with Gabby ultimately coming to the rescue. The Gabby team is led by Jean-Marie Monietti and Daniel Masters, who cut their teeth as commodities traders at Lehman Brothers and J.P. Morgan, respectively. They bring considerable capital markets experience to the Bitcoin space. Prior to purchasing XBT provider, Gabby had created a Bitcoin fund intended for institutional investors called the Gabby. The fund is domiciled in Jersey, United Kingdom, an area known for its innovative approach to regulation, similar to the Cayman Islands. By purchasing XBT provider, Gabby strengthened the reliability of the counterparty to the Bitcoin ETNs and added a nice asset to its growing Bitcoin investing platform for institutions. The rationale was summed up by Masters. Global Advisors Bitcoin Investment Fund, Gabby, is the only fully regulated Bitcoin investment fund targeting institutions. And in adding XBT, we are addressing the online retail and professional markets. The ETI option. Another Bitcoin investment vehicle for investors is the exchange-traded instrument, ETI. ETIs are similar to ETFs in that they are asset-backed securities, whereas an ETN doesn't have to be backed by the underlying asset. However, ETIs are much less common and are primarily intended to house alternative investments such as futures or options. In July 2016, a Bitcoin ETI was listed on the Gibraltar Stock Exchange under the symbol BTCETI. It charges a 1.75% management fee, placing it below both Grayscale and XBT provider, and custodies its assets with Coinbase. While the sponsor and arranger of the ETI, Revoltura and Argentarius ETI Management Limited, are not well known, what is notable is the involvement of the government of Gibraltar and Gibraltar's regulator, the Financial Services Commission. It is clear that Gibraltar sees an opportunity and is making a play for itself as a virtual currency hub. Albert Azzola, Gibraltar's Minister for Financial Services and Gaming, said, "We continue to work with the private sector and our regulator on an appropriate regulatory environment for operators in the digital currency space. And the launch of this ETI on our stock exchange demonstrates our ability to be innovative and deliver speed to market." In the same month as Gibraltar's Bitcoin ETI announcement, a Swiss issuer called Von Tobel announced a tracker certificate for Bitcoin that appears to operate like an ETN, though the details are sparse. July 2016 was a busy month for capital markets-focused Bitcoin products, but represents only the beginning of what we expect to see as the years roll on. Can an investor feel comfortable with the pricing of crypto assets? As the innovative investor may have noticed, many of the exchange-traded products listed above rely on price indices. While a price index sounds simple, it can be a complex mathematical process to assess the exact price the market is offering, especially for crypto assets that trade globally and can be purchased through a wide array of fiat currencies and crypto assets. However, pricing is important for the future growth of capital market vehicles holding crypto assets, so it is an area of development that the innovative investor should watch. The pricing problem is particularly acute for Bitcoin that trades in different geographies and with different fiat currency pairs. Currently, the operations of different crypto asset exchanges can be thought of as isolated liquidity pools. So if one exchange is experiencing significantly stronger demand than other exchanges, the Bitcoin on that exchange may trade at a premium to other exchanges. In the equities markets, such differences in price would quickly be solved by arbitrage, but due to time delays in moving Bitcoin between different exchanges, not to mention fiat currency capital controls, these pricing discrepancies persist. The combination of growing interest in Bitcoin and recognition of the need for robust and regulated Bitcoin indices has led two major investment markets, the New York Stock Exchange and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, CME, to implement their own Bitcoin indices. The New York Stock Exchange launched its Bitcoin Pricing Index, NYXBT, in May 2015. At the time, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, Thomas Farley, said, "Bitcoin values are quickly becoming a data point that our customers want to follow as they consider transacting, trading, or investing with this emerging asset class." As a global index leader and administrator of ICE, LIBOR, ICE Futures, U.S. Dollar Index, and many other notable benchmarks, we are pleased to bring transparency to this market. The NYBXT methodology utilizes data-based rules that produce what they feel is an objective and fair value for one Bitcoin. The index initially began by taking data from Coinbase, in which the New York Stock Exchange had a minority investment, though it has since branched out to include other exchanges. In the latter part of 2016, the CME Group also launched its own Bitcoin price indices with the CME CF Bitcoin Reference Rate and the CME CF Bitcoin Real-Time Index. It also created an independent advisory committee, including Bitcoin evangelist Andreas Antonopoulos, to oversee its pricing model, which utilized prices from various exchanges throughout the world. Many have speculated that this index could be the precursor to Bitcoin futures and other derivatives products, which is CME Group's specialty. We commonly use the Trade Block Index, XBX, which is a leading Bitcoin index for institutional traders of Bitcoin to get the most accurate price of the asset throughout a trading day. Intended for institutional investor use, the index derives a price for Bitcoin using algorithms that account for market liquidity, manipulation attempts, and other anomalies that occur throughout the global exchanges. While all of the aforementioned indices are Bitcoin-focused, we expect to see many indices focused on other maturing crypto assets appear. This will foreshadow more capital market vehicles to come. Talking to a financial advisor about crypto assets. David Berger, creator of the Digital Currency Council, believes the time has come for financial advisors to be able to discuss Bitcoin and crypto assets as they relate to their clients' portfolios. Advisors need to understand the technological underpinnings of Bitcoin, as well as how to hold, securely store, and utilize it. Advisors also need to understand the digital currency ecosystem and the ways to evaluate risk and invest wisely within that ecosystem. They should familiarize themselves with the financial and tax implications, as well as the legal and regulatory issues, all of which are developing daily. Currently, GBTC is available for typical investors through brokerage firms. With an online and self-directed investment account, investors should be able to get a quote on GBTC and buy the asset for their accounts. For investors with an advisor at a wealth management firm, placing the order for GBTC may require interfacing with your advisor so the firm can make the purchase. It won't be uncommon to get some pushback due to a lack of awareness related to this investment vehicle from financial advisors, whether they're independent or from a wire house. At this point, innovative investors should recognize that Bitcoin and other crypto assets can have a positive impact on their investment portfolios. Financial advisors and investment firms would be well served to be knowledgeable, informed, and open to discuss these investment vehicles appropriately with clients. Fortunately, the financial services industry is warming to these investments and the need to bring advisors up to speed. In 2014, the Financial Planning Association, FPA, produced a report clearly detailing its take on the matter, titled "The Value of Bitcoin in Enhancing the Efficiency of an Investor's Portfolio." The FPA supports financial advisors and others associated with the Certified Financial Planner, CFP, certification. In the report, it asserted that for many investors, Bitcoin could provide a potential opportunity to diversify and boost their portfolios. Although we expect that advisors will increasingly become aware of and knowledgeable about Bitcoin and crypto asset investments, the innovative investor may encounter an immediate dismissal, a sense of curiosity, some level of knowledge, or perhaps just a chuckle from his or her advisor on the topic. Given this, here are some points to consider. 1. A good advisor is truly looking out for his or her clients. Bitcoin and crypto assets are new and have short and volatile track records, so the advisor's immediate negative reaction or dismissal shouldn't be a refutation of his or her quality as an advisor. 2. Investors should be prepared to provide links and resources to educate the advisor. 3. Remind the advisor that it's not about putting everything in these investments, and his or her advice can help identify where these assets may appropriately fit in the asset allocation model the advisor has built. If there's no asset allocation model or financial plan the advisor can reference, that should be a red flag for the investor. 4. If the advisor doesn't believe in these assets or refuses to invest in them on the innovative investor's behalf, the asset can be purchased directly as outlined in Chapter 14, or by purchasing GBTC through a self-directed account. If the investor takes this route, we highly recommend informing the advisor of this investment so the advisor can include it in his or her records as reference for the advisor's asset allocation plans. Good advisors should be open to keeping records of client assets held away from their firm. 5. If the financial advisor is a deer in the headlights on the topic, hand him or her a copy of this book. Independent Financial Advisors versus Wirehouse Advisors. Rick Edelman, one of America's top financial advisors, agrees with Berger. Edelman is an author and speaker and has been named America's top independent financial advisor 3 times by Barron's Magazine. Now we can add Bitcoin Believer to the list. It's important that investors stay aware and knowledgeable about Bitcoin, Edelman says. Beyond Bitcoin, Edelman sees great potential in blockchain technology as a solution for many businesses that he believes can benefit from advancements made in this technology. Edelman's attitude as an advisor may be unique, and one reason may be because he's an independent financial advisor, which is different from a wirehouse-based financial advisor who works at Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, or Merrill Lynch. Wirehouse advisors may have more constraints on their ability to recommend investment vehicles related to Bitcoin or crypto assets. This may be due to those firms having internal policies that keep their advisors from recommending products that haven't been fully evaluated by their own internal research teams, or simply by a lack of knowledge and interest in these assets as investment vehicles. What's next? We believe that crypto asset investment vehicles will continue to proliferate, broadening exposure to even the most conservative investors who will eventually realize the uncorrelated value add of this new asset class. Even though the SEC didn't approve the Winklevoss or SolidX ETFs, we believe international regulators will continue to explore this innovative new asset class, which ultimately may help to raise the SEC's comfort level with Bitcoin and crypto assets. That said, the SEC's priority is consumer protection, and if it feels there are still not enough consumer protections in place for Bitcoin and other crypto assets, then it has no obligation to approve any exchange-traded products. Globally, securitization efforts will continue around Bitcoin, which will open the door for other crypto assets that hold true merit, like Ether, to be incorporated into capital market vehicles. Grayscale has moved forward with the Ethereum Classic ETC Investment Trust, which operates similarly to the BIT, but holds Ether Classic, not to be confused with the much larger asset, Ether. Ultimately, we see a future in which there will be numerous options to invest in capital market vehicles that securitize crypto assets. For example, we expect there to be multi-asset mutual funds with crypto assets used for diversification. Similar to REX Shares S&P 500 Gold Hedged ETF, we may someday have an S&P 500 Bitcoin Hedged ETF. Similarly, we will likely have funds of crypto assets based on their functionality, such as a crypto commodity fund, or perhaps a fund of the privacy-focused cryptocurrencies like Monero, Dash, and Zcash. Lastly, given the growing trend of indexation as the crypto asset space matures significantly, we could see network value-weighted crypto asset ETFs, including potentially a basket of the top 5, 10, or 20 crypto assets. In the last 2 chapters, we discussed how the innovative investor can gain access to Bitcoin and crypto assets from a wide range of vehicles, including mining, direct purchases from exchanges, and capital market investments like GBTC and its kin. Another exciting part of the crypto asset world for the innovative investor includes the ability to get involved directly with the developer teams, launching crypto assets from the beginning. In the past, this world was open only to the wealthy. But with new trends such as crowdfunding, token launches, and innovative regulation via the Jobs Act, opportunities exist for innovative investors of all shapes and sizes to get involved. Chapter 16. The Wild World of ICOs. During the early tech days, innovators such as Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Michael Dell became iconic figures who had turned ideas into multi-billion dollar businesses. Over the last decade, we've seen visionaries such as Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and Mark Zuckerberg do the same. These innovators changed the world because people believed in their visions. And these early believers invested money to turn their ideas into reality. While these investments brought great benefit, they were not based on altruism. Initial investors were looking to get a sizable return on their risky investments. Investing in early-stage private companies is most often referred to as venture capital. The term itself conveys the risk involved. After all, venture as a verb conveys a journey into the unknown, and capital refers to wealth and resources. Venture capital is just that, risking the unknown in the pursuit of outsized rewards, but knowing all along that the probability of failure is high. Venture capital is a relatively young industry, intimately entwined with Silicon Valley. While Silicon Valley made venture capital the famous industry it is today, venture capital made Silicon Valley. One of the earliest and most widely recognized companies that helped jumpstart the venture capital industry was Intel, which today produces the chips in most of our computers. The company was started in Santa Clara, California by well-known and highly regarded scientists, Gordon E. Moore, famous for creating Moore's Law, and Robert Noyce, co-creator of the integrated circuit. But they were hard-pressed to raise money for their new company. Ultimately, Intel found a benefactor in Arthur Rock, an American financier who coined the term venture capitalist, who helped them raise $2.5 million in convertible debentures that included $10,000 from his own pocket. The company went public 2 years later in 1970, raising $6.8 million and providing significant rewards to Rock and those who bought the debentures. Intel was one of the first companies to utilize venture capital as a method of funding its startup, and due to its success, helped pioneer the concept in Silicon Valley. Despite the relative youth of venture capital, many crypto asset firms are now turning the model on its head. The disruptors are in danger of being disrupted. For the innovative investor, it's key to realize that crypto assets are not only making it easier for driven entrepreneurs to raise money, they're also creating opportunities for the average investor to get into the earliest rounds of what could be the next Facebook or Uber. Welcome to the colliding worlds of crowdfunding and crypto assets. The old method, the investor's perspective. Up until recently, the first opportunity the average investor had to invest in a company was upon its initial public offering, IPO, when the company's shares began trading on a well-known exchange like the NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. However, leading up to an IPO, the company had likely gone through numerous rounds of private funding. As a private company grows, there are different names for each investing round, starting with a seed round before moving to a Series A, B, C, D, and so on. In each of these rounds, when investors put money into the company, they typically receive a percentage of that company, which is expressed in shares. Such funding is usually open only to venture capitalists, other private equity investors, or wealthy individuals. An IPO converts those private shares into public shares, which are then traded on a public exchange that the everyday investor can get access to. As the innovative investor can probably infer, the earliest rounds, when the risks are highest, are often the most profitable rounds for an investor if the company succeeds. On one hand, keeping these rounds shielded from the public protects the average citizen from the inherent risks of these early stages of investing. But on the other, it also excludes them from the opportunity. Compounding the issue, over the last decade, companies have been waiting longer and longer to go public, which places more and more of the returns in the private markets. Ben Evans, an analyst at Andreessen Horowitz, one of the most famous venture capital firms in the world, published a report in 2015 that clearly laid out the value shift toward private markets. The median time for a tech company to IPO in 1999 was 4 years, whereas in 2014 it was 11 years, meaning the average investor now has to wait nearly 3 times as long to get access to company shares. Although there's less enthusiasm for IPOs than there was during the tech boom, much of the delay is due to regulatory changes as a result of that tech and telecom boom, as well as the financial crisis of 2008. In the late 1990s, companies used to IPO with $20 million in annual revenue, whereas in 2014, the median annual revenue was just shy of $100 million, which had come down from a peak of nearly $200 million during the financial crisis. While this trend has resulted in more stable IPOs and reduced risk for capital market investors, with less risk, there's often less reward. As Ben Evans wrote in his report, almost all the returns are now private. Old world tech giants returned plenty in public markets, new ones if not. By old world tech giants, he's referring to companies such as Microsoft, Oracle, and even Amazon, all of which have provided much more value creation for public markets than private markets. Meanwhile, with companies like LinkedIn, Yelp, Facebook, and Twitter, the clear majority of returns have gone to private investors. For example, while Microsoft grew private money 20,000%, it grew public money 60,000%. Compare that to Facebook, which grew private money 80,000% and public money under 1,000%. As Ben Evans put in his slides, for Facebook to match Microsoft's public market returns, it would need to be worth $45 trillion, which is 2.5 times the GDP of the United States. The old method, the company's perspective. While it may seem like the average investor has been excluded somewhat over the last decade, they haven't been the only ones. Most companies are also locked out of the funding model described above, because securing venture capital is an extremely competitive process, and the path to the public market is even more rigorous. For first-time founders who want to approach venture capitalists for an investment, often they must know someone who knows someone. Having such a connection allows for a warm introduction, as opposed to being among the hundreds of cold calls that venture capitalists inevitably receive. To know someone who knows someone requires already being in the know, which creates a catch-22. Turning to the public markets from inception for funding is also rarely possible, as an IPO is a laborious and expensive process. An IPO requires management to file an S-1 with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, go on a roadshow to make investors aware of their offering, pay expensive investment bankers to properly price the public shares, and so on. Due to the laboriousness of going public, only the largest and most successful companies typically pursue this funding path. They do so once they have matured and want access to the even bigger capital pool provided by the public markets. Furthermore, going public allows them to reward their early private investors, who, after the IPO, can sell their shares in the more liquid public markets. Without access to venture capitalists or the public markets, the preferred method for most startups to raise funding involves family and friends, credit card debt, and a healthy dose of faith. The good news is that the internet boom has spawned a stream of aspiring entrepreneurs, and regulations are adapting to allow the innovative investor and innovative entrepreneur to unite around new ideas. A new method of funding startups. During the financial crisis of 2008, debt markets froze and stock markets crashed, causing major and, in many cases, catastrophic losses for the individual investor. To protect investors from similar experiences in the future, new regulations were put into place. Many of these targeted banks and their involvement in the crisis, which ultimately affected the ability of startups to gain access to the capital markets and other traditional funding methods, including loans and borrowing. In part, these regulations are why we have seen an increase in the amount of time it takes for companies to get to an IPO. However, some leaders recognized that the world needed to spur more innovation and not strangle it. They began to question the regulations and used famous internet company founders such as Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Michael Dell as examples of how American innovation has made the country great. These leaders understood that if starting a company and securing funding was made more difficult, America would suffer. Simultaneously, a funding shift was occurring, as many entrepreneurs realized they didn't have to rely on venture capital, family debt, or the capital markets to raise seed money. The internet had become a major force in connecting entrepreneurs to investors through the process of crowdfunding. It allowed individuals and businesses with an idea and plan to seek out other individuals who were willing to invest. What grew out of the inability of entrepreneurs of small or obscure projects to gain access to the more traditional methods of raising capital was a new method for connecting them to all levels of investors. Crowdfunding sites such as Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and others positioned themselves online as a way for connecting entrepreneurs and investors. In exchange for investors pledging money, the project or company promised to return the fruits of its labor, depending on the amount a specific investor pledged. Recognizing that this platform was a fertile ground for scams, the sites implemented policies and procedures to protect investors. For instance, Kickstarter maintains investors' funds in escrow until a project is funded to a sufficiently high level. If not enough people invest, then funding stops and investors get their money back. Many projects have been funded by investors who simply wanted to see it become a reality, while others funded projects to receive the product. To get a feel for what Kickstarter can provide to investors interested in the Bitcoin and blockchain space, simply type those terms into the search box on the Kickstarter site. Opportunities for investing in documentaries, books, games, and application development can be found. Fund a documentary on Bitcoin, for example, and on completion, investors receive a DVD of that documentary. One of the most compelling aspects of crowdfunding was that it not only allowed dreamers to build their product or business, it allowed investors of all levels to participate in seeing these dreams come true. Prior to crowdfunding, in those cases where investors wanted to share in the equity opportunities provided by a startup, they still had to be an accredited investor. While the intention of requiring investors at this stage to be accredited is good, it has the side effect of locking the average investor out of some of the earliest stage investments with the highest returns. In 2012, the phenomenon of crowdfunding came to the forefront of government regulator attention. Fortunately, rather than killing the concept, the government decided to create policies around it and market it to assist startups. The Jumpstart Our Business Startups, JOBS Act, was signed into law on April 5, 2012. It was an acknowledgement of the potential of crowdfunding to provide alternative financing methods for startups. Additionally, the Act sought to provide equity-based opportunities to a wide range of investors, including non-accredited ones. Crowdfunding portals for all investors. The ability of the JOBS Act to open the door to venture capital for non-accredited investors, including crowdfunding and ICO investments, has been a great step forward in increasing the number of people who may be included in these opportunities. One of the provisions of the JOBS Act will be the implementation of portals, online platforms on which investors can find investment opportunities. These portals must be approved by both the SEC and FINRA. Although there aren't currently many such portals, WeFunder is one, over time, the number will increase and provide even more opportunities for investors and entrepreneurs. Additionally, we expect that portals will soon be set up by broker-dealers to provide a combination of investment opportunities with advice and access. The Jobs Act gave non-accredited investors their first opportunity in 80 years to invest privately in startups and receive equity compensation. Although the Act was signed into law in 2012, Title III of the Act, which allows for non-accredited investors, was only put in place in May 2016. Much of this delay had to do with the need for the SEC to be involved and adopt final rules to permit companies to offer and sell securities through crowdfunding. Some of the policies put in place with Title III included restrictions on the length of fundraising efforts, the amount that an investor could invest, and that investments must take place within an SEC-regulated intermediary, either through a broker-dealer or a funding portal. It's expected that even with these restrictions, investors will have more opportunities to gain equity-based compensation for investments in new businesses, including crypto asset-based investments. The barn door of alternative financing methods for startups is wide open, and those involved with crypto asset-based projects have already begun using their technologies to find ways to raise capital. The difference between a crypto asset and a startup. Before we dive into the specifics of how a crypto asset offering is carried out, the innovative investor needs to understand that the model of crowdfunding crypto assets is doubly disruptive. By leveraging crowdfunding, crypto asset offerings are creating room for the average investor to stand alongside venture capitalists, and the crowdfunding structure is potentially obviating the need for venture capitalists and the capital markets entirely. The second aspect is what makes the integration of crowdfunding with crypto assets doubly disruptive, and puts crypto asset offerings in another league entirely separate from Kickstarter. Joel Menegro, co-founder of Placeholder Ventures and former blockchain lead at Union Square Ventures, USV, was the first to encapsulate this idea cleanly in a blog titled Fat Protocols. Menegro's thesis is as follows. The web is supported by protocols like the Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, and Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, all of which have become standards for routing information around the Internet. However, these protocols are commoditized in that while they form the backbone of our Internet, they are poorly monetized. Instead, what is monetized is the applications on top of the protocols. These applications have turned into mega corporations, such as Facebook and Amazon, which rely on the base protocols of the web and yet capture the vast majority of the value. Contrast this model with that of crypto assets, where the protocol layer must be directly monetized for the applications on it to work. Bitcoin is a good example. The protocol is Bitcoin, uppercase B, itself, which is monetized via the native asset of Bitcoin, lowercase b. All the applications like Coinbase, OpenBazaar, and Purse.io rely on Bitcoin, which drives up the value of Bitcoin. In other words, within a blockchain ecosystem, for the applications to have any value, the protocol needs to store value. So the more that applications derive value from the protocol, the more the value of the protocol layer grows. Given many applications will be built on these protocols, a protocol should grow to be larger in monetary value than any single application atop it, which is the inverse of the value creation of the Internet. Interestingly, once these blockchain protocols are released, they take on lives of their own. While some are supported by foundations like the Ethereum Foundation or Zcash Foundation, the protocols themselves are not companies. They don't have income statements, cash flows, or shareholders they report to. The creation of these foundations is intended to help the protocol by providing some level of structure and organization. But the protocol's value does not depend on the foundation. Furthermore, as open-source software projects, anyone with the proper merits can join the protocol development team. These protocols have no need for the capital markets because they create self-reinforcing economic ecosystems. The more people use the protocol, the more valuable the native assets within it become, drawing more people to use the protocol, creating a self-reinforcing positive feedback loop. Often, core protocol developers will also work for a company that provides applications that use the protocol, and that is a way for the protocol developers to get paid over the long term. They can also benefit from holding the native asset since inception. Launching a new crypto asset with an ICO. Initial coin offering, ICO, is the term most commonly used to describe crowdfunding the launch of a new crypto asset. We'd like to expand this term to refer to initial crypto asset offering, as the specific use of the term coin implies that these are currencies, which, as we covered in Chapter 4, is most certainly not the case for all crypto assets. Our definition is more expansive, as many new ICOs relate to the creation of new crypto tokens and crypto commodities. Announcing the ICO. The new crypto asset can be announced any number of ways: a conference, on Twitter, Reddit, Medium, or Bitcoin Talk. It is important that the announcement is followed by a white paper containing details about the founders and advisory board, and that it clearly outlines the structure of the initial crowd sale. It should be easy to contact the founding team, whether through one of the aforementioned social media channels or a dedicated Slack or Telegram channel. If an ICO is scant on information, that is an immediate red flag. The innovative investor should use the relevant aspects of the framework we detailed in Chapter 12 to investigate whether an ICO is a sound investment. That said, things are a little trickier with ICOs than with currently functioning crypto assets. Since ICOs use the crowdfunding model to raise money to build a network, there often is no existing network up and running. Thus, no blockchain, hash rate, user base, or companies built on it. Everything is an idea at this stage. As a result, the integrity and prior history of the founding and advisory team are all the more important, as is the thematic investigation of whether this ICO is filling a marketplace and business need. Structuring and timing of the ICO. ICOs have a fixed start and end date, and often there is a bonus structure involved with investing earlier. For instance, investing at an early stage may get an investor 10 to 20% more of a crypto asset. The bonus structure is meant to incentivize people to buy in early, which helps to assure that the ICO will hit its target offering. There's nothing like bonuses followed by scarcity to drive people to buy. It's best practice that an ICO also have a minimum and maximum amount that it plans to raise. The minimum is to ensure the development team will have enough to make a viable product, and the maximum is to keep the speculation of crowds in check. For example, the infamous Dow ICO didn't set a maximum limit on the fundraising amount, which led to rampant speculation. The offering should lay out how the new asset will be distributed, and how the funds that are raised will be used. Often, the founding team will keep some of the assets for themselves, which is similar to when a founding team of a startup keeps a percentage of the company. What's important is that these terms are fair and accompanied by reasonable explanations. Crowd sale begins. Typically, the innovative investor will submit funds for an ICO by sending either Bitcoin or Ether to a special address the developer team provides. Just as one could send Bitcoin or Ether to an address to pay for an online purchase, innovative investors can send Bitcoin or Ether to an address to reserve their share of an ICO. Depending on the intent of the ICO, investors may receive a cryptocurrency, crypto commodity, or crypto token in return for their initial investment. How an investor receives the appropriate crypto asset can differ, as some may require the creation of a wallet to store the asset prior to making them available for sale on an exchange. Creating this wallet might be a more technical effort and could require following detailed instructions from the ICO provider. Others will simply provide access to the asset that can be moved to an exchange. This can have an impact on the value of an asset if there's a large amount of early sales on exchanges soon after the closing of an ICO. Typically, information on the ICO will outline how the asset delivery process will work, and this should be read prior to making an investment so that there are no surprises for the investor. Keeping track of the ICOs. Numerous online sites list new ICOs and other resources to keep tabs on current and future ones. Smith & Crown is a well-respected firm that's positioning itself as an information source for the ICO world. It provides an updated list of current, past, and upcoming ICO sales. Other resources include ICO Countdown and CyberFund. CoinFund also operates a great Slack community with dozens of threads, many of which are dedicated to conversations about the specifics of upcoming ICOs. Criticism of the ICO model. Daniel Krawitz of the Satoshi Institute considers ICOs snake oil and pump-and-dump scams. Pavel Kravchenko, founder of Distributed Lab, questions if we really need all of these coins and advises, let's think for a moment before participating in an ICO. Could the same technology solve the same problems without the coin? While some ICOs can be from misleading asset issuers or seem Ponzi-like, innovative investors have the resources provided in Chapter 11 to help them avoid such schemes. Others will scream that an ICO is a scam simply because they disagree with the funding model, as can be common with some Bitcoin maximalists. The ICO debate will continue, and it's prudent for the innovative investor to stay abreast of contemporary thinking around the benefits and drawbacks of ICOs. The Howey test for discerning if an ICO is a security. The Howey test is the result of the 1946 U.S. Supreme Court case, SEC versus Howey Company, which investigated whether a convoluted scheme to sell and then lease tracts of land qualified as an investment contract, also known as a security. The Howey test determines whether something should be classified as a security, even if it is referred to differently in an offering to avoid regulatory action. If something classifies as a security, SEC oversight requires a long list of requirements to be met, which would likely dampen all but the most well-capitalized innovations in the exciting new world of crypto asset offerings. If an asset meets the following criteria, it will likely be considered a security. 1. It is an investment of money. 2. The investment of money is in a common enterprise. 3. There is an expectation of profits from the investment. For the most part, the teams behind ICOs want to avoid classification as a security because it will demand hefty legal fees, delay innovation, and require restructuring of the current crypto asset landscape. While most ICOs meet the first two conditions, the third condition is up for interpretation. Do investors buy into an ICO as an expectation of profit, or do they buy into an ICO to gain access to the ultimate utility that will be provided by the blockchain architecture? While the distinction may seem small, it can make all the difference. A joint effort by Coinbase, CoinCenter, ConsenSys, and Union Square Ventures, with the legal assistance of Debevoise and Plimpton LLP, produced a document called A Securities Law Framework for Blockchain Tokens. It is especially important for the team behind an ICO to utilize this document in conjunction with a lawyer to determine if a crypto asset sale falls under SEC jurisdiction. The SEC made it clear in July 2017 that some crypto assets can be considered securities. The document includes a framework for scoring the ICO and identifying its applicability as a security, and thus its consideration in light of the regulations that go along with that classification. Innovative investors may also want to evaluate these criteria on their own in line with what they know about the ICO. If there is a belief by the investor that the offering should be considered an investment contract, and the offering team is moving forward without that assumption, that could be a red flag about the legitimacy of an ICO. The SEC made it clear in July 2017 that some crypto assets can be considered securities. The framework document is also helpful because it includes best practices for an ICO, which provides a good checklist for innovative investors. They are paraphrased below to provide context for what an investor should consider for any potential ICO investment. Much of this overlaps with what has been stated already, but with ICOs, it's best to be doubly sure. Note that in this context, crypto asset is synonymous with token. 1. Is there a published white paper? 2. Is there a detailed development roadmap that includes a breakdown of all appropriate financials along the way? 3. Does it use an open public blockchain? And is the code published? 4. Is there clear, logical, and fair pricing in the token sale? 5. Is it clear how much of the token has been assigned for the development team and how those tokens will be released? Releasing them over time keeps the developers engaged and protects against centralized control of the token. 6. Does the token sale tout itself as an investment? It should instead be promoted for its functionality and use case and include appropriate disclaimers that identify it as a product, not an investment. Angel and early-stage investors. One of the most exciting and potentially lucrative opportunities for an accredited investor is to be an angel investor with a startup. Angel investors can range from the family member who provides capital or a credit card to more formalized angel investors who are either aligned with a venture capital firm or on their own seeking investment opportunities. Angel investments can vary in size from the low thousands to much higher via early-stage investment opportunities. If a venture moves on to more formalized funding after the angel stage, those who invested as angels may see the value of their investment increase, on paper at least. As a company grows and ultimately arrives at its exit strategy of an IPO or takeover, angel investors can achieve sizable gains from their initial investment. The online site, banktothefuture.com, provides angel investing opportunities in crypto assets and related companies to accredited investors. The site has provided opportunities to be angel and early-stage investors in big names, such as Factum, BitPay, BitPesa, Shapeshift, Kraken, and even Bank to the Future itself. It also provides access to mining pools for Bitcoin and Ether, in which investors can gain a daily dividend from the crypto assets mined through those pools. Angel investors may also join online communities such as AngelList and Crunchbase, where accredited investors can connect with startups. Both have robust listings for blockchain-related companies. In fact, AngelList has over 500 blockchain companies listed with an average $4 million valuation and a growing list of over 700 blockchain investors. These sites are great ways to find information on existing startups and venture capitalists, and they can provide the accredited innovative investor with good information and background on the process of being an angel investor and the opportunities therein. One of the oldest groups of angel investors in the blockchain and Bitcoin space is called BitAngels. Michael Turpin of BitAngels has been active in angel investing in blockchain companies for as long as the opportunities have existed. Turpin's annual conference, Coin Agenda, is one of the best opportunities for investors to see and hear management from blockchain startups present their ideas and business models. Each year, Turpin brings together the top startups in the space to present to varying levels of investors. In 2016, the company that won the conference's award for Best in Show was Airbits, which provides a single sign-on platform for blockchain apps. Soon after the conference, Airbits raised over $700,000 on banktothefuture.com. Opportunities for the innovative investor to gain access to crypto assets and the companies involved will continue to grow. We believe that these opportunities will not only impact the way people view their investing philosophy, but will also affect how they work with financial professionals who are involved in their investments, such as their financial advisors or accountants. The innovative investor can't lose sight of his or her financial goals and objectives. Chasing after what seem to be high profit opportunities must be tempered by an understanding of the accompanying risk. Of all the chapters in our book, This chapter has covered material that is moving the most quickly. Therefore, the innovative investor that wants to play in the world of ICOs will need to do ample due diligence beyond what he or she has read here, including staying abreast of statements from regulators on the classification of these assets. We've shown the various and still growing ways investors can gain access to crypto assets. Now that the innovative investor has come this far down the crypto asset rabbit hole, it's time to revisit his or her current approach and investment portfolio in light of what has been learned. Chapter 17. Preparing Current Portfolios for Blockchain Disruption. When Toffler stated in the 1970s that exponential change would cause millions of people to have an abrupt collision with the future, it was issued as a warning. When considering investing in crypto assets, innovative investors need to not only consider an individual investment, like Bitcoin or Ether, but also how this new asset class and the overall concept of blockchain technology could impact other assets within their portfolio. This chapter focuses on the importance of actively evaluating and potentially protecting one's portfolio in the face of exponential change. When pondering the changes crypto assets are bringing to the way we invest today, we must also recognize that the entire concept of blockchain technology heralds significant disruption to companies and industries. For most investors, these disruptions will affect investments that have already been made or are under consideration. For instance, if Bitcoin influences how remittances are handled, what impact may that have on stocks like Western Union, a remittances kingpin? If Ethereum takes off as a decentralized world computer, will that have any effect on companies with cloud computing offerings, such as Amazon, Microsoft, and Google? If companies can get paid more quickly and with lower transaction fees using the latest cryptocurrency, will that have an impact on credit card providers like Visa and American Express? Exponential disruption. Clayton Christensen, a professor at Harvard Business School, wrote the seminal text on how large companies, often referred to as incumbents, struggle with maneuvering around exponential change. In The Innovator's Dilemma, When New Technologies Cause Great Firms to Fail, Christensen makes no qualms about how even the most well-managed of firms can fail when confronted with a technology that threatens to disrupt their market. Broadly disruptive technologies lay the foundation for new growth, with the most influential blossoming into what are called general-purpose technologies, which include electricity, the automobile, the internet, and yes, blockchain technology. While such growth provides many opportunities, even if large companies recognize the potential of a technology, they are often handcuffed when they try to capitalize on it. The problem they face is threefold. First, disruptive products are simpler and cheaper. They generally promise lower margins, not greater profits. Second, disruptive technologies typically are first commercialized in emerging or insignificant markets. And third, leading firms' most profitable customers generally don't want, and indeed initially can't use, products based on disruptive technologies. Pursuing a product line in the new market is not additive to the incumbent's existing business because, as Christensen explains, disruptive products have lower margins, smaller markets, and target a customer base with whom the company is not familiar. Sometimes the new product line can even be subtractive from the company's existing business line, known as cannibalization, because it is superior to other products it already offers. And so customers start buying the new product, as opposed to the more lucrative, for the company, older product. However, avoiding the new technology because of a fear of cannibalization can be the kiss of death. As Christensen points out, the fear of cannibalizing sales of existing products is often cited as a reason why established firms delay the introduction of new technologies. But in disruptive situations, action must be taken before careful plans are made, because much less can be known about what markets need or how large they can become, Plans must serve a very different purpose. They must be plans for learning rather than plans for implementation. Hence, the incumbent that avoids developing products that utilize the new technology may be maximizing short-term revenue, but is shooting itself in the foot over the long term. As Christensen notes, in the early stages of a disruptive technology,